Dr. Alam Jarrar. Dr. Jarrar is a physician and serves as the Director of Rehabilitation and Mental Health Programs for the Palestinian Medical Relief Society, the largest non-governmental organization delivering health care in the Palestinian territories. Dr. Jarrar.
Thank you, Alan. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming today to listen to us. My presentation will be concentrating mainly on the challenges that the health organizations, in particular health NGOs, are facing under the situation of conflict, actually under the situation of a chronic conflict that has been there for decades now. I will be talking about the experience of one of the largest health organizations, which is the Palestinian Medical Relief Society. It's a grassroots health NGO that has been established in 1979. And its establishment at that time was mainly to respond to the needs of Palestinians living under the Israeli occupation. And at the same time, when established, one of the objectives was to build the resilience of Palestinians to cope with the difficulties that they are facing because of the Israeli occupation, and also trying to introduce a new perspective on health, especially community health perspective. Our belief that health is a human rights issue, and we believe that it's not merely about, you know, providing services and giving services. It's rather a status of well-being that could not be guaranteed without ensuring basic human rights, whether political or civil human rights. PMRS actually believe, which is Palestinian Medical Relief Society, believes in that is social justice is the way for better health. So we believe that what determines the status of health is certain social determinants. And in our context, we're talking about also political determinants. We also believe that community participation is a key to ensure health, quality of health for people. And we also, at the same time, believe that health should be approached in an integrated approach. It's not only the health sector that provides health services, but also other sectors should be involved in this. PMRS working in, as we say, in an unstable political environment. And the same feature of our work, of the health organization's work in the situation of conflict, is the lack of access. Lack of access in terms not only of affordability, that people cannot receive services, but also people cannot reach those services because of the geographical and political obstructions and considerations. We are living through what we call a social suffering. The social suffering is due to the severe conflict that has been there for a long period of time. Actually, when we talk about Palestine, we talk about a country that is under siege, the country that is actually divided in three geographic areas. One is in Gaza, which is completely sealed off by the Israeli army. One is the West Bank, which has many problems, including the checkpoint regime problem. And Jerusalem. East Jerusalem is completely segregated from the rest of the areas of the West Bank and Gaza. So people cannot move from Jerusalem to West Bank. West Bankers cannot move to Gaza and vice versa. Just a few words about the history of the conflict. The impact of the conflict, actually, when it started maybe 64 years ago, millions of refugees have been fled outside the country to other neighboring Arab countries. Oppression, deprivation, and exclusion were the main features during the last 60 years. We just, in brief, can describe the situation in four major maybe situations. One, we live under military occupation for now in the areas of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem for more than 40 years. We are going through a colonization process, so the Israelis are actually moving some Israeli population into the West Bank by establishing settlements and settlement posts. We also suffer from racial discrimination. So in Palestine, actually, what has been built over the 40 years is two systems, one for Palestinians and one for the settlers that are residing inside the Palestinian areas. And when we talk about the situation in Palestine, we have not to forget that we are going through a very severe social distress and social injustice for the population. This is a map that shows actually the facts on the ground in terms of Gaza, West Bank, and Israel. Dr. Rahama Martin has mentioned that more or less there are 4 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including Jerusalem. And more or less there are 7 million people living in Israel. Out of them, there are 1,600,000 Palestinians. Just a few words about Oslo. I think everybody in the room knows about the Oslo Accord that has been concluded in 1993, and when signed here in Washington, there were hopes that the problem will be on its way to be solved. Unfortunately, after more or less 19 to 20 years, what's happening on the ground, this map, as you see, Israel has taken advantage of the signing of Oslo agreement and was establishing settlements during this period. More than 120 settlements were established, and more than maybe 300,000 Israeli citizens were moved inside the areas of Palestine inside the settlements. Oslo was supposed to be, with two stages. One transitional that should have been concluded after 5 years, in 1999, and a permanent status after 1999. A Palestinian state should have been, concluded and established. Unfortunately, nothing of this has happened. And on the contrary, what happened is new complications. Israel has built what we call the apartheid wall. 600 kilometers of this wall, 4 meters high, was built on the Palestinian land, segregating Palestinian areas from each other. The wall has resulted in problems of obstruction, including the problem of access to health services. So the problem of access has been identified as a major problem, whether in terms of reaching out by medical services to the population, or the citizens can go and receive services from the health sector providers. This slide shows the outcome of the Israeli checkpoint regime, how they call it, and soldiers are deciding whether people can move if they need certain medical care from one place to another. It's the soldier who decides whether this woman needs medical care or not. It's not the doctor who decides, actually. Obstruction of health services and obstruction of people in moving from one place to another is, as I said, is the main feature. These are signs of that has been put by the army that you cannot go through this area, which is a Palestinian area where people live on both sides, actually. Some words about poverty. After those years, what we are living through is a very severe, as I said, social distress, and poverty is a main feature of social of living in the Palestinian areas. According to the UN figures, 80% of Gaza people are dependent on food baskets, so, and more or less 60% of the people are under poverty line. In the West Bank, more or less like 30 to 35% of people are under the poverty line. Poverty is a social phenomena, and certainly it affects and it impacts the health, status and health situation of the population. It also results into low education status, low social class, low income, and income inequalities amongst the population. What we believe in this concept of social determinants that are impacting the health situation of the population. So adverse life events, poor housing, hunger, education, social support are the major areas where people suffer from social determinants. Health outcomes, whenever you have poverty and you have social difficulties, the demand for services is getting bigger, and the ability of the system to deliver those services will become a little bit less. Health consequences are also include exclusion and stigma and adverse social economic consequences. Health conditions, I just listed three major health conditions that we are living through in Palestine, just to show what kind of health impact that has been there due to the political and social difficulties that we are living through. One is the stunted growth amongst children due to ill nutrition, and there have been many studies that have been conducted by many universities, whether local or international, that show the ill nutrition status of Palestinian children. Second, social suffering resulting in deterioration of mental well-being. And this is a major problem that needs a lot of programs that deal with the with this situation in the Palestinian society. And the last condition that we see is very serious is the non-communicable disease problem that is rising, although we are living through what we call the third world problems when it comes to health situation. Our response to those conditions mainly is how to reach out people and not to let them wait until they go to health services. What we do is try to mobilize health professionals, and we also cooperate with many organizations, including Physicians for Human Rights, to reach out people and to provide services despite of the obstructions that are there. We also believe in social action. We believe that, as I started my presentation, saying that health is not only about and merely about physical condition. It's also about the well-being of people, whether it is social or otherwise. And we believe that social action is a way of building the resilience of Palestinians. And thus, we try also not only to provide services, but also to do social actions to build resilience of Palestinians and enabling communities to strengthen their resilience, addressing the needs of the marginalized groups, and influencing social and health policies. We also believe that we are part of civil society organizations that are struggling for civil rights and political rights as well, and advocating for democratic and civil values, and defending human rights of Palestinians in front of the existing political structures, whether in the West Bank or Gaza. And the last slide that I just want to show, that the main challenge, I put some challenges in terms of our work, but I opted just to put this one challenge that is, I think, of utmost importance, is just to keep the spirit and to go on. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Girard. I'd like to open it up for any comments or questions from the floor for any of our panelists, sir. So the question, two-part question, was why are the Palestinian, why is the Palestinian territory still relying on the shekel? Why doesn't it have its own currency? And secondly, why are the Palestinians relying on the Israelis for their supply chain? Why not go to Egypt through the Rafah crossing? Maybe Dr. Girard would like to address those.
Me too.
And Dr. Martone.
I will respond to the second part of the question. Actually, we want not to rely on Israel, and we are eager to do that, but unfortunately the realities on the ground is dictating on us that we have to, because Israel is controlling all exits and entrances to the West Bank and Gaza as well. And just this entrance, that is Rafah crossing, they call it, it's under a regime that has been signed with the European Union and also with the, what we call quartet, I mean UN, United States and the European Union, that Egypt is not violating, it's just transferring or allowing people to get through with a certain amount of, figures or numbers day by day. And no commodities whatsoever are allowed, to cross this Rafah crossing. The commodities and medical supplies should enter from the Israeli exit or border crossings, which are located one on the borders of Egypt. The other one is the Aris famous crossing. So here we are. We are trapped, and we cannot. We cannot do anything about this, and we are negotiating now with the Egyptians, if possible, to reopen what we call the agreement that has been signed maybe 5 years ago with regard to Rafah crossing. But what we do is trying to improve inside Gaza health services in order to cope with the difficulties. As for the first question, I just couldn't get it. Can you just... yes, this is a very good question, because this is exactly what is... yes, actually we are not allowed to our monitoring, they call it system, monetary system, but it's a political decision by Palestinians that can just get outside the frame of Oslo. And this is exactly what is discussed now, is how to get rid of the, what we call the problems that Oslo has created. One of them is the dependence on the monetary system of Israel. Thank you.
Though Dr. Alam answered everything, I would like to add, the Palestinians are under occupation. They cannot decide for themselves practically anything. They cannot collect their taxes. Israel is collecting the taxes, holding the money as a tool of pressure against them. They cannot create a currency under the Oslo and even under the Madrid and Paris and all kinds of agreements. They just cannot do it. In Madrid, which was a little bit before Oslo, a very good friend of mine, the late Dr. Haider Abdel Shafi, he was one of the prominent medical doctors in Gaza Strip. He resigned from this delegation to Madrid because he said there is no way that I, as a Palestinian, will accept this transfer of education and health or medicine from Israel to the Palestinians, because if I cannot, as a Palestinian, if I cannot control the borders, if I cannot choose where will I buy the medications and the equipment, if I cannot control the borders in order to send my people to get education, if I cannot control the borders in order to give the sick and ill people, Palestinian people, to go wherever they wish to, so what kind of acceptance of this health ministry? It means nothing. So he resigned. And to my great sorrow, the rest of the Palestinian delegation were not that foresighted as this intelligent person was. And they are eating it up to this very day. This is why your question was such a good one.
Maybe we have limited time. We can come back to you if we have a chance, but yes, right here in front. So to repeat the questions, the first was any work being done on the psychosocial status of the losing side in these civil conflicts? And the second was, has there been work that documents the consequences, psychosocial consequences of the combatants and the civilians in the Biafra conflict in Nigeria?
Be fairly quick because the answer to your second, I don't know anything about the conflict in Nigeria, so I can't speak to that. As far as psychosocial and health outcomes in the losing, so one, I would say no one's really specified, in part because everybody loses. So there's not quite they win or. So for example, I'll take Burundi just as an example. So Burundi, if people don't know, is right next to Rwanda. Has a population of maybe 8 million people, and they had a double genocide of Hutus and Tutsis, similar to the one that happened in Rwanda, just not at scale. The last fighting force demobilized in 2006, and it was, so there are two rebel groups. One is CNFDD, and one is FNL. Right now, those two rebel forces were fighting against the national government. Now the war is over, the president is part of CNFDD. So he's kind of in charge now, and he's joined with the national government. And so now they are targeting those who are part of the FNL. And a lot of the child soldiers actually mixed. So sometimes they would go into the CNFDD, they would try to escape. If they were successful, they would then be re-recruited into the FNL, into the opposite. So there's just a lot of intermingling, and it's hard to say whose sides people were on. Yeah.
Thank you. I think you had your hand up there. So the question for Dr. Martin was, How does some of the work of PHR Israel, such as the mobile clinics, get beyond the just the purely humanitarian that she has identified and towards the social action that that Dr. Girard addressed?
Good question.
Thank you. I can't imagine a better question for me, really. We are absolutely not doing humanitarian aid. It's for us, it's really number one, not to do any kind of humanitarian aid. We are using medicine in order to create solidarity, in order to make it obvious that we are protesting against all these things. We wish that our work would not be necessary. What we are doing, our main thinking is that being physicians for human rights, the human rights comes first. We are not fighting against viruses or microbes or things like this. Only, by the way, what we are really struggling against or fighting against is what the wrongs that men, usually it's men, but let's say people are doing to other people. This is our business. And torture, solitary confinement, all kinds of oppression, humiliation in the border or elsewhere, this is our main thing. And by using medical or health actions, they are really our business as well, but they are instrumental for building the bridge between the two societies, and especially trying to show an alternative way to the segregation and oppression. So thank you.
I'd actually like to add a little to that. It is an excellent question. I myself work with a couple of organizations that are political organizations working in the United States against the U.S. government's policies of support for the Israeli government, whatever it does, American Jews for a Just Peace and Jewish Voice for Peace. We have a health and human rights project which sends delegations, including medical professionals, to work alongside our partner organizations, Physicians for Human Rights Israel and the Palestinian Medical Relief Society. And when we go, we participate in clinical activities, including teaching activities, but we see patients. But that's not the reason that we do it. What we can contribute materially is so tiny, it's hardly of any significance in the big picture. You know, we'll see patients like we do at home, but that's a very, very small contribution. But the reason we do it, which are, I would say, two very important reasons. One is we think that our presence as clinicians and as public health people is important in showing the local population that they're not alone, and that not everyone from the United States supports what our government is doing, which they are very well aware of. And in our case, that there are, you know, Jews from both Israel and from the United States and elsewhere who understand, who are trying to understand their situation and doing whatever we can back home to stop it. And the main reason is that we can have this firsthand experience of contact, both at the human level but also as clinicians, with the local population, and come back and share this experience in any way we can, including at a meeting like this, with people in the United States who don't get it and really need to get it. That this, it's my firm belief that this conflict would be over if our own government would decide that it's no longer going to support the Israeli state and the Israeli government unless it stops its behaviors as an occupier. So that's our main reason to do it. It's an excellent question, and I would never ever suggest that what we do in this little project is because we think it's really going to make a big difference in the health status of the population. It isn't. We know that. It's real, but it's tiny. Are there other? Yes. Yeah, so the question is, how can it be that the American Jewish community, which its leadership is very strongly in support of the government of Israel and its actions, how is it that all of us, the rest of us Americans, could be quiet in the face of this, of our government's apparent, if I'm restating this correctly, of our government's acquiescence, let's say, to the Israeli government, especially through the support of the, at least the leadership of major Jewish organized Jewish community. Well, I'll take a stab at that first, and then I'll happily pass the microphone. But I think it's true that the American Jewish community, first of all, is in some sense, this is my personal opinion, but I think it's widely shared that the American Jewish community has a mindset that is still largely determined by the German genocide of now two, three generations past. And there is a myth, I think it's a myth, that's been promulgated within organized Judaism that Jews need their own state, our own state, because the world is this place that will turn on us at any moment and extinguish us, and we have to have a state, and that means a military, and that means the strongest, what, the fourth strongest military on the planet, to ensure that Jews can always go back there and be safe, which is kind of a contradiction, because in my view, there's no place that's less safe for a Jew to be than Israel, believe me. But over the decades, there has been such a deep connection, a military connection, a diplomatic connection, now an intelligence connection between the elites in Israel and those in the United States, that it is profound. And the money that backs this connection is also enormous in the form of AIPAC, for example, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, has a budget of $90 million and a staff of thousands that's all lobbying and the direction of large pools of money from very wealthy Jewish donors into specific congressional campaigns. To the extent that people, I think it's true, in Congress are frightened to take a stand. And when they did, David Hilliard for one and Cynthia McKinney for another, they were ousted from their seats, primarily by AIPAC money from outside of their districts. And so even to identify the presence of an Israeli lobby dominating American political discourse is an act of courage. And when John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt wrote their book, The Israel Lobby, and these are two mainstream academics, very prominent in foreign affairs, they were they were reviled and attacked, and there was an attempt made to silence them in various ways, and that happens a lot in the public world in the United States. There are cracks appearing. I think the emergence of J Street is a good example of an organization that has some credibility now on Capitol Hill. But there is this is a real serious uphill battle. I'd like to ask if anyone else would like to comment on that.
Ellen was very clear on that, and I think what we feel as Palestinians whenever it comes to the position of the United States towards us. I mean, from one side you see Americans, the United States, are preaching values of democracy, human rights, respect of, you know, people's dignity. On the other side, they are just silent when it comes to Palestinians. And our, you know, it's inside us that has been year by year grown up this kind of why? Why? Why is this is not applied to us? It applies everywhere, but not for Palestinians. And this is the question that should be answered by you, not by us.
Patrice? The question was for Dr. Song as to whether the rehabilitation efforts following the cessation of hostilities as related to child soldiers involves reproductive rights as well as the other things detailed by Dr. Song.
So it's an interesting question because I think a lot of people, well, first, we know that sexual and gender-based violence is extremely common, that there are different cultural norms around what's appropriate as far as what your role is as a woman. There are many, many groups that do reconciliation and peace building amongst youth, actually. So there are right now a lot of NGOs that are starting that are helping, and actually UNICEF and some other larger, like Save the Children, they're building in some programs that talk about child rights and justice. Is there have I seen a reproductive rights component in that childhood? I haven't seen anything as far as the childhood developmental age. I think they're more focused on child rights and protection against violence and family abuse, domestic violence. I think where reproductive rights comes in and the international organizations are more at the adult level, and unfortunately many times it's not preventive, but it's in response to seeing a lot of women who have been survivors. And I think that's kind of the common. I think right now people are trying to be more preventive, and they're doing lots of education. And I think one of the most important things is to include men into that conversation. There are different organizations. There's one in Rwanda. Oh, I forgot his name. Wonderful. Where he's doing kind of an issue about sexual gender-based violence rights from a male perspective. So he's having groups of men that come together and they talk about masculinity and what that means and how that role changes over time.
Other questions and comments? Until they chase us out of here, I think we could continue the conversation. Otherwise, I would invite people to the round table. As I say, our panelists can't be there. I'll be there, and anyone else who's interested, and that is at 4:30 in this building, Gateway Ballroom 103. I'd like to remind you about our tomorrow's session, sponsored by the Peace Caucus at 12:30, Organizing Health Workers for Peace and Justice Within and Beyond APHA. That's in this building again, Esplanade Ballroom 302. And please, if you haven't taken one of the flyers related to the movement to have TIAA craft divest from the Israeli occupation and to have our governing council be part of that movement, please take one of the flyers in the back, and if you'd like to sign a petition, whether or not your retirement fund personally is with TIAA CREF, please do sign. I hope that the APHA Governing Council will pay attention if a large enough number of APHA members express their opinion in this manner. So thank you very much for your attention, and hope to see you soon, perhaps this afternoon.